In the 50s and 60s, a unit at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio collected and investigated UFO sightings, and included quite a few in Wisconsin communities. The Air Force concluded that most of those reports were due to easily explainable reasons. What people thought were visitors from somewhere else were often planes, weather balloons, reflections from the setting sun, and the like. But some cases aren't so easily explained. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Today, we're taking a look at some reports documented in the files of Project Blue Book, that is the name for the UFO unit, most of which are available through the National Archives website, and talking about the UFO phenomenon in general. Author and podcaster Mark O'Connell, whose credits include co-executive producer and on-camera expert on the reality show UFO Witness, is our guest. Mark, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. It's nice to be here. I appreciate the invitation a lot.
It's been a couple of years since we've had a conversation, but we're still just as fascinated with UFOs as ever, are we not?
We are, and still just as clueless about UFOs in a lot of ways.
And
there's no other way to say it.
That's true. It's true. It's unfortunate. I thought that by now we'd know for sure what's out there, but still we don't.
Oh, I know.
Well, let's start off by talking about your background, how you got into this field, and what brought you to this point.
Oh, boy. Okay. This could get long and boring, so feel free to cut me off if I'm giving you too much. I've been interested in UFOs, aliens, spaceships ever since I was a little kid. I'll date myself here. When I was 3 years old, my mom watched the premiere episode of a new science fiction TV show called The Outer Limits, and it had a really scary alien made out of energy. And it scared the dickens out of me. And this is my first conscious memory. I'm 3 years old. This alien shows up on the TV screen. I go running upstairs to the top of the stairs and hide around the corner. And I tell my mom, tell me when the monster goes away. I'm not coming back down until the monster goes away. And to this day, I wonder, what was my mom thinking? Does she have any idea how she traumatized me by watching that show? So that's kind of how it started. And I've just been fascinated by these topics ever since. And then I started kind of working in this field professionally several years ago. And that's made it a lot more interesting, a lot more fun, because I get to investigate a broader range of events. And I get to do these fun TV shows, and it's been a really fascinating experience. I remember a time early on when I was just starting to cultivate this, recultivate it as an adult, like 7 or 8 years ago. And I just remember my son looking at my wife and saying, "Monica, we need to talk about Dad." And I reacted the same way. I just laughed. I was like, "You guys just watch. This is not a joke." So they learned.
Well, you clearly got over your fright of the alien in Outer Limits. I remember that show too. That was a crazy series.
It was terrifying.
Yes, it was. But then, you know, talk about some of your professional things that you've done. You've been a writer, you've a podcaster. Mm-hmm. Talk about some of that stuff.
Well, my big claim to fame is in the 90s, I wrote several episodes of Star Trek, one episode of Next Generation. I did not get my name on the credits on that one. There's a whole long story behind it all, Writers Guild rules and politics and stuff. But it got my foot in the door. And after that, I did 4 episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which is interesting. For a long time, Deep Space Nine has been sort of the black sheep of the Star Trek family. But in the past few years, it's sort of come into its own, and it's been getting critically reviewed, and people are starting to see the genius of the show Deep Space Nine. It was a darker kind of Star Trek than they had done before. So I'm really proud to have been associated with that. In fact, Variety magazine recently did a list of the top, I think it was the top 57 Star Trek episodes of all time. And one of my episodes, Who Mourned for More, Mourns for More, was number 33. So
yay!
I'm like, yeah, 33rd best Star Trek episode, according to Variety magazine.
That's pretty great.
That's my claim to fame. So I did that for a while, and then shifted gears in the aughts and had an opportunity to write a UFO book. I was doing a goofy little UFO podcast just kind of to amuse myself. And in the course of all my research, I kept coming across mention of this organization called CUFOS, the Center for UFO Studies. And lo and behold, they were right down in Evanston, Illinois. And at the time, I was living part-time in Wisconsin and part-time in Chicago. So I started visiting the center. And after a couple of visits, the director said, "Hey, I've been reading your podcast and I enjoy your writing. Would you like to write a book about our founder, J. Allen Hynek?" And I jumped at the chance. I knew all about J. Allen Hynek. He was a very famous UFO investigator, and he had founded the Center for UFO Studies. So to be asked to write his biography, a book about his career, was just the most amazing opportunity. So I jumped at the chance and spent the next several years researching his life and his work. That book came out in 2017. It's called The Close Encounters Man. And that led to the TV gigs and some other things I'm working on now. So it's been a really fun and interesting trajectory.
So the biography that you wrote, that guy was closely associated with that film, right? The Close Encounters of the Third
Yes.
Kind. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. That film was really based on a lot of Hynek's work. He wasn't really credited for it. In fact, if I can tell a funny story. So I'm doing this research early on in the stages of working on the book, and I'm looking through the CUFOS files. They're just a stack of beat up old file cabinets in someone's basement in Chicago. And I see the folder with the letter S, and I open it up, and there are two names jump out at me. One is Sagan, Carl Sagan, the famous astronomer. The second S name was Spielberg, Steven Spielberg. So, of course, I went straight to that file and started looking through it. Very first document in the Spielberg file is a letter that Dr. Hynek wrote to Steven Spielberg saying, "Hey, you kind of ripped off one of my terms for the name of your movie. And you never asked me. I think we should talk." And, you know, and the letter was, it was almost comical. Hynek was trying so hard to be diplomatic and not be angry about it. But at the same time, you could tell he's kind of ticked off.
He had to be mad, right? Yeah.
Yeah, he's kind of ticked off. Spielberg is using this term that Hynek had published a book in which he developed and explained his Close Encounters terminology. So Spielberg had just lifted that from Hynek's book and never asked him, never paid him. So
terrible.
I find this letter, this awkward letter from Hynek to Spielberg. And then there's a response from Spielberg, and he's saying, "Oh my gosh, Dr. Hynek, I had no idea. One of our production assistants suggested your book, and I made sure everyone in the crew read it, but I didn't realize that I was, you know, using something that you had created. I'm so sorry." And then Spielberg says, "And anyway, we're not naming the movie Close Encounters anymore. We're naming it Watch the Skies." Well, that ended up changing also. Mm-hmm. In the end, I'll cut to the chase. In the end, the two brilliant men, Spielberg and Hynek, they both behaved like grownups. They worked things out. Hynek gave them permission to use the title Close Encounters of the Third Kind. They hired Hynek to be on set as a technical consultant for 3 days down in Alabama, which is where the movie was being shot. And so basically they both got what they wanted in the end. And it, funny little footnote to all this, once all the dust was settled and the movie was released, one of the things Hynek negotiated for was a phone number for his Center for UFO Studies was printed in the lower corner of every movie poster for Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Really?
Yeah, just a little note in the lower corner of the movie poster that said, "If you've seen anything weird, call this number." Yeah, so that's how that whole story turned out. It's one of my favorite stories. It's not really a UFO story, but it's fun.
It is very fun. I wonder how many people saw that and called with something. I mean, do you think there was some response?
Oh, there was. There absolutely was. The folks I was doing my research with at the center said, oh, yeah, when those posters came out, the phone was just ringing off the hook.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, I mean, can you imagine being on the set of Close Encounters? I mean, as a
Oh,
UFO enthusiast, how much would that have been like cool for you?
Oh, but there's more I almost forgot to mention. In addition to Hynek being on set, he actually got on camera. Spielberg filmed a cameo appearance of Dr. Hynek. People who know the movie inside and out, as many people do, will recognize that in the final act of the movie, when we're finally coming face to face with the aliens in the coming out of the mothership, there's a 6 second shot of Dr. Hynek among all the scientists sort of gazing at the UFO and the aliens. And Hynek sort of pushes his way to the front of all the scientists, and he fiddles with his pipe and fiddles with his goatee like he's been known to do. And that's it. It's a 6 second scene, but it's Hynek's moment. That's Hynek's movie career right there.
So very cool. Now I'm going to have to pull that movie out and watch it again.
Yeah, you should. And Hynek told a really funny story that I was able to use in the book about how Spielberg went on and on with this cameo shot, and they set up things where the children who were dressed up as aliens were encouraged to go like play with Hynek's pipe and stick it up their nose and stick it up Hynek's nose, all sorts of goofy stuff.
Well, like an
None of
alien
that.
would do. Like, what is this stuff? And
Sure. None
yeah.
of that made it into the movie, of course, but it's a again, really funny story.
It is a funny story. What do you think it is that just draws people to this, the desire to know what's out there and who's out there? What is it that is so pulling for us?
Well, I think there are probably a lot of reasons, but one of the things that I think makes a lot of sense is I think we all kind of wish we could meet another civilization that's doing better than we are. And I don't mean that to sound like, everything's wrong with our world, but we're getting some things wrong. And it's nice to think that there are other civilizations out there that, and clearly in the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the aliens are presented as very benign, friendly even, and wanting to interact with us in a positive way. And I think that's kind of a dream of a lot of people, that if we end up making contact with some sort of alien intelligence that has figured a few things out that we're still struggling with, I think a lot of the appeal comes from that.
You're hearing Mark O'Connell on Route 51. We're continuing our discussion on UFOs. Soon we will get into some documented sightings in Wisconsin communities as well. We'll pick up this conversation ahead. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Shereen Seward, continuing our discussion on documented UFO sightings in Wisconsin and the whole UFO phenomenon. We've been combing through some declassified Project Blue Book documentation over the last week and want to talk a little bit about the latest findings on unidentified aerial phenomenon. Our guest today, again, is Mark O'Connell. So I want to ask you about Project Blue Book. What do you know about it? I know the project closed, way back in 1969, and these are older sightings, but it's kind of interesting to see what people had reported throughout Wisconsin all those years
Oh yeah.
ago.
Oh yeah, it's really fascinating. You can get drawn in so easily. Blue Book, Blue Book is sort of it's been good for ufology, and it's also been bad for ufology at the same time. A lot of people, when they think of Blue Book, they immediately think of government cover-up, conspiracy, it's no job. They're trying to hide the facts about UFOs with Project Blue Book. And I think there is some truth to that. And, there probably has been some skullduggery that's gone on at some point or another to try to suppress information. That wouldn't surprise me at all if that turned out to be the case. But at the same time, you know, even if you think Project Blue Book is this evil, evil conspiratorial entity, it still houses, as you've been pointing out, hundreds, maybe thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of legit UFO sighting reports. And even, you know, the Air Force could try to explain it away all they want, but the reports are still there. Hynek used to say, people used to ask Dr. Hynek, do you really believe in UFOs? And his answer was, I believe UFO reports are real, mm-hmm. which is, you know, that's a very safe mm-hmm. way to say it, but it's also a very correct way to say it. We have all these reports. The reports are solid gold. I mean, some of them are goofy. Some of them are silly. Some of them, you know, defy belief. But a lot of them have some real meat on the bones. So yeah, the Blue Book, and I tend to look at it as Blue Book is a good thing because it's this repository for an incredible amount of UFO knowledge. And just because the Air Force misused it or didn't use it, as the case may be, that doesn't mean that the document itself is wrong or is flawed in any way. It's just the way it's been handled that's caused so much, you know, grief and upheaval over the years. And Hynek was a victim of that. You know, he worked for Project Blue Book as the scientific consultant for nearly 20 years. And he didn't always get treated very well by his employers at the Air Force. The Air Force would often squash Hynek's opinion, keep him away from the media because they were afraid he'd say something embarrassing to the Air Force. So Hynek was mistreated very badly, but at the same time, he stuck with the Air Force no matter how many times they pulled the rug out from under him. He remained employed with them because, again, it gave him access to these thousands and thousands of case reports that he loved to study. So that's my big overview of Project Blue Book. It still wields incredible influence in the ufology field. You know, it's kind of the, like it or hate it, it's kind of the gold standard.
There's always suspicion that the government is covering up the truth about UFOs, but I guess the big question is why? Why would they want us not to know about these kinds of things?
Well, there's one very good potential reason for that. And again, this is something that Dr. Hynek used to say all the time. You can cover up something you know, but you can also cover up something you don't know. And Hynek always suspected that as far as the Air Force and Project Blue Book were concerned, they were covering up the fact that they know nothing. After all this research, after spending millions of dollars and devoting thousands of man hours to trying to research and understand the UFO phenomenon, and they've still got nowhere. So Hynek thought, yeah, they're just covering the fact that they haven't produced any results. And why haven't they produced any results? Probably because they're just going about it the wrong way. So that's kind of where that's kind of where that ends up.
Is there a better way? I mean, did he think there was a better way to have analyzed these reports?
Yeah, and he tried to do that. You know, when Blue Book ended in the late 1960s, and Hynek was no longer employed by the Air Force, he was suddenly free to do or say or investigate anything he wanted. And it turned out there were several really high profile UFO events that transpired after the end of Blue Book that Hynek was able to say, hey, this one means something. You know, there's a lot going on in this case that we seriously cannot explain. Mm-hmm. There's definitely something going on here. So Hynek was much freer in his expression of belief. Mm-hmm. And that made the world a safer place for anybody who had ever seen a UFO, but who was afraid to talk about it because they were afraid to be ridiculed. Here's this guy who's now become a national media star, and he's not afraid to say, yeah, there's something going on with these UFOs. And mm-hmm. Hynek was, you know, and he got a lot of press. He was on a lot of talk shows. He was interviewed a ton. He was written about in magazines and newspapers. He was a pretty famous guy, and people really listened to him. He was America's UFO guru.
When we look at Project Blue Book, I filtered through the results, and there are hundreds in Wisconsin. I mean, more
Yeah.
than 300 in Wisconsin. It seems like a lot. Talk about some of the sightings you know about, and it doesn't have to be from there, but that you know about that really stand out to you.
Well, there is a fun one, and I want to talk about it because it's so interesting. It took place in the early 1960s outside of Eagle River, Wisconsin. The witness was a guy who was apparently a gentleman farmer. He raised chickens, worked as a plumber. His name was Joe Simonton. And one day, Joe looks out his window and sees a UFO landing in his yard. Some big oval shaped craft that descends from the sky lands in his yard.
My gosh.
So Joe, he does what anybody would do. Joe goes out into the yard and is like, "Hey, what's going on?" Well, a door opens in this object and two men come out. And Joe described the men as looking like they were Italian, whatever that is supposed to mean.
Okay.
So these two men come out of the UFO, and one of them is holding something that looks like a water jug or a thermos. And they signal to Joe that it's empty. So Joe takes it and goes over to his well and say, like, "Here, I'll refill your thermos." So Joe refills this container from his well and he gives it back to the two men. And then the two men beckon him over to their apparent spacecraft and let him look inside the open doorway. And inside, there's a third man standing at a galley, standing at a kitchen, making pancakes. I am not making this up. This is the official UFO report from Joe Simonton. And these men gave him a stack of flapjacks, and then they got into their craft, the door shut, and it flew away. Well, so now Joe's got this stack of extraterrestrial pancakes,
Thanks.
and he wants to know what to do with them. Well, Joe had a friend, a local judge, who got super excited when he heard about Joe's experience. And this judge just happened to have connections with the Center for UFO Studies in Evanston. So the judge contacts CUFOS. CUFOS sends up one of their best investigators. They fly up to Eagle River. Actually, Heideck was actually along on the trip too. They go up to Eagle River. They interview Joe. Joe gives him one of the pancakes. CUFOS has the pancake analyzed by a test lab, and they find that it's just a perfectly ordinary buckwheat pancake. It has some unusual perforations to it. That was like the only thing they could come up with. But that was so. That was the end of the affair. They couldn't really prove anything for the pancakes. Heineck was a little dismissive of the case, not because he doubted Joe, but because he felt that if there was only one witness, then there were no witnesses. He had
Yeah.
to, for him to really, invest in a case, Heineck had to know that there were at least two witnesses, hopefully separated geographically, who saw the same thing at the same time and could describe it the same way. And he couldn't get that with the Joe Simonton case, but he still came away with a favorable opinion of Joe Simonton. He felt that Joe wasn't BSing him. So that's where that case ended up. I have some personal experience as part of my research for the book. I signed on for about 5 years as a certified UFO field investigator working for the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, which a lot of people recognize now from all the UFO TV shows that they get involved in. So for 5 years, for part of that time, I was even the assistant Wisconsin director for investigations. And what would happen is I would get maybe two, three times a week, I'd get an email about a case that had come up that was close to where I lived at the time in southern Wisconsin. And it would be up to me to investigate, which basically meant following up with the person who filed the report, having them tell the story again in the hopes that they remember some more details from what they wrote in their initial report. And boy, I experienced some really, really fascinating moments doing that work. One of the ones that really sticks out with me involved a married couple who were driving at night across northern Wisconsin. They were heading to visit some friends in Algoma, I believe. And so they're driving on this deserted two-lane highway, in the middle of nowhere, Wisconsin, and they see a light in the sky up ahead, and it's moving like right to left across their field of vision, and they just take it to be, oh, that's a satellite or a low-flying airplane or a meteor or something. But they sort of watch it with fascination and realize that this ball of light is now approaching their car, or at least approaching their highway, and it crosses over the highway ahead of the car and settles down into a gully alongside the road. Well, the couple keep driving, and as they drive past that gully, what they see is a house with all its lights on. And they sort of are like, this happens a lot in UFO cases. They're kind of like, they don't know what to believe. Their senses seem to be playing tricks on them. Like, how is that a house? It looked like a fireball a second ago, and now it's a house with all its lights lit up. And they just sort of shrug it off, like, oh, well, can't explain it. So they go on and visit their friends. And when they get to the friend's house, the friends are like, hey, you guys are late. You guys are like 15 minutes late. What happened? And the husband and wife kind of look at each other like, what did happen? They were missing 15 minutes and they really didn't know
Really?
what happened. Yeah. So they spend the night at their friend's house, and on the way home the next day, they get to the point in the highway where they had seen the light come down and turn into the house, and they're super excited. They're like, okay, we just got to get a look at this house and then we'll know what we saw. Well, they get there and there's no house there. There's nothing there.
Whoa.
So yeah, so the guy is telling me this story, and it's hard to judge whether someone's being sincere or not, but I felt he was being sincere because I could detect the tension in his voice when he was telling this story, like he's not sure if he should be telling it or not. And I found him really credible and really convincing. He wasn't making any really wild claims. He was being very matter of fact about the experience. So we talked for a while, and I took a lot of notes on what he had told me. And I said, you know, it would be great is if I could talk to your wife about this too. Because again, two
Two
witnesses is
witnesses.
way better than one witness. And he said, well, I wish you could, but he said, we're divorced now. And she never wants to talk about that night. He said she refuses to talk about it. So you'd never get anywhere, even if you tried to talk. Which, that's an interesting detail. That's kind of like, that kind of bolsters the credibility of the story, at least for me. Over the years of doing this, so we never like solved that case. We rarely do because, what is there to examine? Whatever this thing was, it's gone now.
And you never got to talk to the wife. You
Never
weren't
got
able.
to talk to the wife, really, really wanted to. But here's something interesting that came up though when I was investigating these cases. A lot of people, when I first started talking to them, they would start the interview by asking me two questions. And the two questions were, number one, what did I see? And number two, has anyone else ever seen it? And anytime a person started out the conversation with those two questions, I thought, okay, you are sincere and credible to me because you just asked those two questions. Because you're more concerned about just getting it right, than you are about like grandstanding or, putting on a show, which a lot of people do in that milieu. So that sort of came to be my gold standard. If they started out by asking me those two questions, they got a check mark on my report right away as being like, okay, initial impression, this person is really means what they're telling me. Can I tell a Minnesota story?
Of course you can.
Oh no, there's another Wisconsin story I have to tell you first. I almost forgot.
Okay.
So I mentioned a couple of the UFO investigation organizations like MUFON and KUFOS. And there's a third that was very, very famous in its heyday in the 60s and 70s called APRO. That's APRO, the Aerial Phenomenon Research Organization, was founded by a couple from Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin. Jim and Coral Lorenzen. Coral had actually seen UFOs twice in her life. And she and her husband were, they were true believers, and they saw a need for someone to do serious investigation. And they sort of became, I keep talking about gold standards. The Lorenzens were kind of the gold standard for quite a while for UFO investigation. They were taken very seriously. They had thousands of members around the globe, and they were in business for several decades. And like these other organizations, they amassed a huge treasury of case reports. The interesting thing to me about this story is, so a couple of, I'm just going to call them apparent grifters, latched onto the Lorenzens and ended up in possession of the Lorenzens' case files, and promptly hid them away in a warehouse for 30 years. And it was for 30 years, this was this enduring mystery. Where did they put the case reports? Why are they hiding them? You know, none of the reasons seemed very good. But I was able to actually interview the grifters for my book. This was the first time they had spoken publicly about the APRO files in 30 years. And they gave me a few clues in the interview that I was able to put in the book, but they didn't, you know, they didn't really fess up or anything. But I'm making this a long story. Just a few months ago, the grifters like showed up at the door of one of the leading UFO documentarians and said, you know what, here are the APRO files. We don't want them anymore. We're giving them to the UFO community. So right now, the gentleman, David Marler, down in Arizona, is going through those APRO files and looking to see what's of value. And it's kind of interesting and exciting, sort of waiting to hear what Dave's going to come up with from going through those APRO files. So that's kind of a cool Wisconsin story there. But the Minnesota story, this is actually one of my favorite UFO cases because it, to my mind, it involves serious, hard, physical evidence that cannot be denied. And it can't be denied because it involves a police car in Minnesota, a sheriff's deputy named Val Johnson. I think this was 1979, late 70s sometime. This deputy Johnson is out on patrol. He's in Marshall County, Minnesota, which is way, way up far northwestern corner of Minnesota, pretty isolated. This guy's out on night patrol. He sees a really bright light coming down the highway. And at first he thinks it's like a small aircraft that's in trouble and is about to make an emergency landing. But then as he gets closer, all of a sudden the light he's watching just sort of shoots into the interior of his police car and blinds him. And he wakes up 40 minutes later. His car has spun out on the road. There are skid marks. There's damage to the car. His watch and the clock on the dashboard of the car have missed like 40 minutes. So two clocks registering the same time discrepancy. And this guy, he's got retinal burns. So his vision has been affected by this encounter. So this case gets really serious, serious attention from CUFOS because, like I said, there was some hard physical evidence, namely a police car that had physical damage to it. The right. Antennas on the roof of the police car were bent over 45 degrees.
Whoa.
The windshield was smashed. And a glass expert analyzed the windshield and found that the cracks in the glass, some of them were caused from the inside, from the sheriff's deputy whacking his forehead on the windshield, but some of them were also from the outside. So something actually collided with the windshield of this police car. One of the headlights was smashed. One of the roof lights was smashed. And it got a lot of publicity at the time, but the witness, Val Johnson, he was a very reluctant witness. He granted a few interviews, and after a few, he just clammed up. And his only public statement was, "I value my sanity, and I'm just going to leave it at that." I'm learning about this case as I'm writing my book. And thinking, oh, man, I so wish I could talk to this guy and do an interview. But just from his public comments, he made it very clear that that would not be welcome. So reluctantly, I had to give up on that plan. But here's the kicker. The car is on display at the local history museum, and they have not fixed a thing, and nobody's ever explained it. And the CUFOS investigators were at a complete loss. They couldn't attribute anything. Nobody could figure out anything about this car except that the damage was real. And this guy did give a credible report until he clammed up. Someday I really want to get up to northwestern Minnesota and check out the history museum and see the car, see the Johnson car. You know, and nobody could ever explain the missing 40 minutes either. That was the other weird thing.
Yeah,
and,
that is
and
weird.
He did indeed have retinal burns, and he needed to have his eyes treated for a while after the incident.
Wow, that is quite a story.
Yeah.
I'm Shereen Seward, along with Mark O'Connell on Wisconsin Public Radio's Route 51, a discussion on investigating unidentified flying objects reported throughout the years. We'll be back with more in just a few moments. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. We continue our discussion on UFO investigations. It's one of my favorite subjects to discuss. And Mark O'Connell is our guest on Wisconsin Public Radio. He stays with us for the rest of the hour. Any other really cool sightings you want to share with us?
There is another favorite story of mine. Technically, it's not really a sighting. But when I tell you the story, I think you'll understand why I'm so fascinated by it. One of the cases I was assigned involved a woman who she no longer lived in Wisconsin, but for some reason her case got ended up with the Wisconsin team, and it ended up being sent to me to investigate. So I contacted this woman, and she tells this really, really, really bizarre story about how she had visited Chicago several months earlier with a friend, and they had gone out to eat at this really neat restaurant. They had never heard of it before, but it was really great, and they loved it, and the food was great, and they just had such a good time there. And then when they were driving back home, I think they had come from Iowa originally. So they're driving back to Iowa the next day after they had this fantastic dinner. And they start talking about the restaurant, and they realize they don't really remember much about the restaurant. It's kind of like, do you remember there being any waiters? Oh, I'm not sure. Were there any other customers? Were we the only people there? Oh, yeah, I think maybe we were. So these two friends go through this process driving back to Iowa where they're trying to connect their memories together. And the harder they try, the weirder it gets, because they start realizing, oh, yeah, I'm not really sure any of that happened. So it just so happens the woman has to go back to Chicago for her job again the following week. Mm-hmm. And this time she takes a different friend with her. And she says, yeah, we're going to go out to eat at this really, really weird restaurant that I was at a couple of weeks ago. So they go to the same part of the city where the restaurant was. The restaurant was called Restaurant X, by the way.
Okay.
So they go back to where Restaurant X was, and there's nothing there. It's an office building.
Really?
And they go inside the office building, and they're like, okay, that's where our table was at when we ate, but there was a window there, and now there's no window, and everything architecturally, everything about this space was different to them.
Weird.
So, yeah. So again, not really a UFO sighting at all, but definitely a potential for a missing time mm-hmm. experience. And missing time experiences are commonly associated with UFO sightings. So
That was my next question. I mean, how often does that happen when you're looking at these cases that people are missing time?
I had a surprising number of missing time reports. Really? There was one young man who believe he lived right around Elkhorn, and he was driving home from his girlfriend's house one night, and something was wrong with his car. So he pulled over to check the car. And while he was pulled over, he saw something up in the sky that was approaching him. Well, next thing he knows, he's back at his house. Some time has, like an hour or two have passed. And somehow his car's working again, and he has no idea what just happened.
Really?
So that was an interesting one. I don't remember all the details from that. But yeah, the missing time thing comes up surprisingly often. And sometimes it's not just missing time, but it's sort of, their perceptions are sort of masked by something, like the two women at the restaurant. Their perception of reality is being manipulated somehow, or that's the way it seems. I have a really good friend from high school who had a similar experience. He and his sister, when they were kids, were out in their backyard playing, and they saw a weird circular thing zooming by in the sky. And as they kept looking, somehow it turned into an airplane. And the airplane disappears, and my friend and his sister kind of look at each other like, did you just see a weird looking airplane?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, I did. And they're like, huh, that was weird. And then they went back to
kids,
play because
yeah. Mm-hmm.
they were kids. They saw something weird, and that was that.
Mm-hmm. What do most people see? I mean, when you look at these reports, what are some commonalities? Is it like weird lights, strange shapes? What's most common?
Well, that's really hard to say because there's such a variety. Sometimes it's triangles, sometimes it's orbs. Orbs really had a moment for a while a few years ago, especially with MUFON. That's one of the reasons I left MUFON, because they were saying everything in the sky was an orb. Well, okay, but what is an orb? Please explain that to me. Well, they never do. So so there are triangles, there are orbs, there are lights in the sky. And that's where Dr. Hynek's categories come in. He started categorizing sightings as there would be nocturnal meandering lights, pretty obvious explanation. There would be daytime disks, also a pretty obvious explanation. Or third of all, there would be radar reports, which were always a big deal. Whenever you've got a radar picking up a solid object, and you've got a witness on the ground looking at that object and saying exactly where it is, and you can look at the two descriptions of the location and realize, oh, they're talking about the same thing. So that's always a big thing too, the radar, visual and radar reports. In my experience with people in Wisconsin, well, here's an interesting one. I was living in Fort Atkinson at the time, so south central Wisconsin. And one summer I had, I think, four in a row sightings right in the Fort Atkinson Whitewater area. So I investigated them all. To the best of my knowledge, the four families did not know each other, had no connection to each other, and yet they all explained in almost exact detail to me what they had seen. They had seen sort of a glowing orange ball that was sort of smoky and cloudy around its edges, and it was moving slowly across the sky towards the east. Maybe it was towards the west. Got to get this straight.
Okay.
Moving slowly across the sky. And one of the people, one of the families, the father and son, actually hopped in their car and tried to tail this thing and kept on seeing it up ahead in the sky and kind of lost track of it at some point. It sort of disappeared into the cloudiness. But I thought that one was really, really curious. I'm still not a total believer that that was completely legit, but it was pretty fascinating. So we had our mini flap. When there's a whole bunch of sightings that take place all at once, they call it a flap.
Okay.
So we had our own little mini flap that summer with those four cases.
When you go to investigate some of these reports, I mean, do you go into it with a sense of skepticism, or do you go in as a believer?
I like to give people the benefit of the doubt. I feel like if they had the guts to report something along these lines, then it's worth listening to them and hearing them out. I guess you could say I go into it as a believer. I'm open-minded about it. I believe a lot of things. I don't believe everything, but I am pretty open-minded. I do think there's a fundamental reality to the UFO phenomenon. So, yeah, if somebody's got an interesting UFO tale to tell, I'm all ears. And the interesting thing is, when, you know, once I started sort of opening up about this, my work with UFOs in public, with friends and stuff, I'd have these conversations. I can remember so many times when I've been talking to a friend or a relation about my UFO investigations, and there'll be somebody else standing nearby, and this person nearby will just sort of shyly come over and say, excuse me, I heard you were talking about UFOs. And I'm like, yeah, that's right. And he goes, well, I saw something once. Can I tell you about it? You would be amazed at how often that happened. There are so many people out there who have seen something they can't explain. And that's all a UFO is, right? It's something that they can't explain. It may be something perfectly normal, but it's appearing to them in a way they've never seen it before. That's always possible. It could be a misperception. But the fact that so many people have seen something that puzzles them and even troubles them, I find really, really intriguing.
And those experiences kind of stick with you. My brother and I saw something, gosh, it's probably 15, 20, it might even be 20 years ago now, but, and we still talk about it. I mean, we still talk about that night we were at the Wisconsin Valley Fair, and this blue green bright big light was above the beer tent, and we were with a couple of other people, and we, I mean, all four of us saw it. But people around us were just acting like there was nothing going on. So we were like, are we the only four people on Earth who are seeing this thing or what? So I mean, we still talk about it to this day. It's one of those things that just stamped on your memory.
That is really, really fascinating. And again, that goes to the whole bit about perceptions. Can we trust our perceptions? You saw something that was plain as day to you, but nobody around you seemed to notice it.
Yeah, the four
That's
of us all saw it. And we're like, what
weird.
is this thing?
That
But
is just
yeah.
weird.
It's very weird. Yeah,
But
very weird.
very, very cool. And I don't doubt you at all. I totally believe your story because I've heard similar things from so many other people.
I know what I saw. I just don't know what it was. You know, I know I saw something. I just
That's
don't know what.
the classic UFO witness line. I know what I
I
saw.
know what I saw.
That's them's fighting words.
Back to the guy who wrote the theme song to Route 51, the program, this program is one of the guys who was with me that night and saw the same thing. So anyway, very strange, but so when people see things that they think might be a UFO and then that's later debunked, what are they usually seeing? Is it something like a plane or is it a weather? I mean, what's the typical thing that explains those things away?
Well, I'm thinking of one case where, and this was a young couple in Madison who had seen something weird in the sky when they were out on a summer day. And at first, their story sounded believable, but the more I heard, the more it sounded like it was an atmospheric thing, a sun dog, which is something that the sun sometimes does on hot, misty days. And so I had to tell them, I think this is what you saw. And sometimes they're disappointed by that. Sometimes they're kind of relieved. You just never know.
Yeah.
But people want it resolved one way or the other.
Definitely. I mean, yeah, you kind of want to know what it is that you've seen. So take me through an investigation. Somebody gives you a report. What do you do?
I go over the report and look for inconsistencies in the initial report. That's the first thing. I can tell you some pretty wild stories about the way people fill out some of these report forms. Some of them are just really, I can't even go there. So I'll go over the case report. I'll start thinking of questions I want to ask people. And then I just, you know, I reach out to the witness. I give them a phone call. I never try to be like, can you tell me right now what you saw? I just like to call and introduce myself and say, hey, would you be able to talk sometime like in the next week or so? Your call, whenever you want to do it, whenever you feel comfortable. So you give them a little leeway. And generally people will be interested in talking. And in fact, a lot of times they'd be like, I can't believe you called me. I didn't think anybody would get a hold of me. I'm like, no, we really do this. We really do call. We really do get in touch. You know, and some of these people are just amazed by that. So we set up the interview, we do the interview, and the interviewers are just fascinating. There's just no way of telling, you know, what direction they might go. And that's when I start hearing these stories, like the couple with the fireball that turned into the house that turned out to not be there. You know, that all came out of the primary interview with the primary witness. So you do that, and then you just kind of you look at the evidence, you look at the descriptions, and you try to figure out how to categorize this event. And 90% of the time, you're going to just check off insufficient data, because that's the only honest thing you can really say. Insufficient data. We just don't know enough to be able to say what this is. So it remains unidentified. It remains a UFO. But every once in a while, there will be an interview that's just so compelling, like the woman with Restaurant X that came out in a phone interview. I was so intrigued by this story she was telling me
Yeah.
about this ghostly restaurant who's with walls and windows that kept changing position. And that one just really threw me.
Well, thank you so much for sharing this with us. I love these conversations. I'm so glad you were able to come on in and talk with me today.
I'm glad you invited me in. It's been a pleasure.
This is Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward. Once more, extending a sincere thanks to our guest, Mark O'Connell. Ezra Wall and Joy Ratch-Kramer assisted in producing this program. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program, as well as our previous programs, at wpr.org/route51 and on your favorite podcast platform. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.